both their other teachers or preachers are sick this week. Marshall had kidney stone. I don't know if everyone has heard that or not. I think he passed that Wednesday. But he's had high blood pressure as well. And I think John and Cindy are both sick with some kind of stomach stuff going around. So they're both out. We're in the book of Micah, the fourth chapter. I want to give you just a little bit of historical setting for what is going on during the time that Micah is prophesying. Micah and the prophet Isaiah were contemporaries. They both lived and prophesied to both Israel and Judah. And if you remember, after Solomon was king of the United, what we call the United Kingdom, where all 12 tribes were still together, after that, there was a civil war of sorts, and Israel was divided. And 10 of the tribes went with what is called Israel from that point on in your history, and the other two tribes became Judah. The 10 tribes, their capital was at Samaria. The two tribes, which is called Judah, their capital was at Jerusalem. The two tribes consisted of Judah and Benjamin, and the other 10 tribes were, of course, Israel. God had promised David that a descendant of his throne would be on the throne in Jerusalem forever. As long as there was a nation of Israel, his descendant would be on the throne in Jerusalem. And you can follow the lineage and you can follow the kings, the succession of kings in both Israel and Judah. And you can see that there is something similar about both of them. Both of these kingdoms, their morality and the stability of their country fluctuated greatly. It was up and down. It was up and down. There was strife. There was attempted assassinations. There was assassinations. There was stuff going on where there was a constant, it seemed like, grab for power. And someone always wanted, just like it is around the world today, someone always wanting to overthrow this king and take over themselves. And it was always that way, it seemed like, to some extent or other, in both Israel and Judah. In Israel, this succession of kings went from one family to another to maybe even another. There may be a king who was succeeded by his son, and things seem to be going well, and then, who knows, some general or somebody else may assassinate him and take over. In Israel, the 10 tribes, there was not a blood succession. There was not a blood lineage. But in Judah, there was still the same amount, it seems like, just in reading through the history, of chaos. There was still the same degree of turmoil. And yet, you can study the succession of kings, and it is father, son, 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 all the way through. Just as God had said that it would be. Israel, was the 10 tribes, was finally taken over by the Assyrians in about 720 or so B.C. That's probably within 10 or 20 years of that. Another 150 or so years passed before Judah met the same fate at the hand of the Babylonians. Well, about the time Israel was about to fall, around 710 B.C. or so, 720, 730, somewhere in there, Micah is living, and Micah is prophesying. The book of Micah, a short book that we call one of the minor prophets, 7 chapters long. I don't think that we can take this book as it was Micah stood up one day in the public square and gave this oracle of this whole book. I doubt if that's the way it was. I suspect that the contents of the book of Micah were given, the oracles were given over a period of time. It might have been a week. It may have been 5 years. It may have been 10 years. I don't know. But I don't think it's one setting. I think Micah is giving these oracles and this prophecy from God over a period of time as his nation is going through the things that they're going through. Now here's what is happening. The Assyrians are a world power. And the Assyrians are taking over just whoever they please. And so at some point, they have come to Israel. They have come to Samaria, where the capital of Israel is. And they've laid siege around this capital. And at some point, the king and the government of Israel makes a truce with the Assyrians. Sennacherib eventually became the king of Assyria. And Israel and the leaders of Israel really become just a puppet of the Assyrian king. They'll do whatever he says to do. He lets them live. He continues to take from them whatever he wants to take, and they'll be happy with it if they know what's good for them. They live in fear of the Assyrians. And they are being ravaged by whatever the Assyrians want to do to them or to their land or their people or whatever. And Jerusalem, Judah, the two tribes, see all this going on, and they are, you might say, shaking in their boots. They realize that at any time he wants, this Assyrian king could probably take them over. And there comes a day, perhaps after Israel, the ten tribes fall, I'm not sure of the timing, but there comes a day when the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, sends a messenger and an envoy to Jerusalem with a message for King Hezekiah. And he tells Hezekiah, "Do you realize what I could do to you? I could take everything that you have." And he threatens Hezekiah. He says, "You think that you could stand against me? You think you could maybe call some reinforcements and make a treaty and a pact with the king of Egypt, and he would come and help you? Look at all the kings and the countries I've come through. What do you notice about them? They're gone. They're wiped out. They are finished. I've taken everything that they have." And Hezekiah makes a truce with a short-lived, it's really not a truce, but he makes an agreement with Sennacherib, the king of Assyria. And just as he did with Israel, Sennacherib takes whatever he chooses. And Hezekiah is hard-pressed to meet the demands for silver and gold that the king of Assyria is demanding from him. He scrounges up all of the silver that he can find. He resorts to taking the gold off of the overlays on the temple pillars, taking the golden doorknobs off the temple. Can you imagine what the Jewish people are thinking when the most holy place in their country, they see it being dismantled and taken apart and the precious gold taken from it and given to a king? Sennacherib tells him, he says, "I can lay siege around you, I can surround you, I can cut off your supplies, and the day will come," and this is sort of crude, but this is what he says, "the day will come when you will be glad to eat your own dung and drink your own urine." I will cut you off. The people are ravaged. The people are fearful. They are troubled. And it is in that kind of situation that went on for 40 or 50 years that Micah is living. And Micah is prophesying. We saw in chapter 4, the first five verses, where Micah mixes his prophecies. There are things in the book of Micah that he is prophesying, this is fixing to happen to you shortly. There are things in the book of Micah that are prophetic statements that will even haven't happened yet. And chapter 4, it is one of those. We're going to start reading in chapter 4, verse 1. If you want to, and you can do this if you want to. This might be an interesting thing. Some of you turn to Isaiah chapter 2. I want to show you something interesting. Isaiah chapter 2, and we'll begin reading in verse 2. Verse 2 to 4. Isaiah 2, 2 to 4. You follow along there. I'm going to read from Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. And notice how similar they are. Isaiah 2, 2 to 4, and Micah 4, 1 to 3. I'll be reading from the book of Micah. Verse 1, it will come about in the last days that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and the peoples will stream to it. And many nations will come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us about his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For from Zion will go forth the law, even the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between many peoples and render decisions for many distant nations. Then they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they train for war. Was that similar? Very similar, isn't it? All right, this is called a floating oracle. It is an oracle that is found in more than one place, and it will usually be in the Old Testament, always in the Old Testament. And like I said, Isaiah and Micah are contemporaries. They are prophesying to the same people. It is very reasonable to think that God would give the same message to the same people. If he gives it by two different speakers, two different prophets, the message is still the same. I'm going to continue reading in verse 4 of Micah, chapter 4, verse 4. And each of them will sit under his vine and under his fig tree, with no one to make them afraid. For the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken. Though all the peoples walk each in the name of his God, as for us, we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. Now these five verses are a prophetic oracle of things that have not yet happened. All right, speaking of a time when Jesus Christ, the Messiah, will reign. I want you to notice something about the reign of this king, the reign of the Messiah. First of all, he says, people will go up to the mount. There will be a desire, a strong desire among the people on the earth to worship God, to go to the mountain of the Lord, a usage of where God meets them. To go up to the mount of the Lord and learn from God. A desire. There is a desire, he says, in the people to worship. There is a desire to be taught. There's a desire to learn, to know God. And then the next thing is the law will come down from the mount of the Lord. The law of God will come from God and be spread throughout the earth. The next one, there will be peace in the land. He says, we will take your spears and beat them into pruning hooks. You will hammer your swords into plowshares. People will take, in other words, they will stop making implements of war and use the metal that would have been used to make implements of war and instead make agricultural tools, things to sow and to reap and to plant crops. There will be peace in the land. There will be plenty in the land. Everyone, he says in verse 4, will sit under his own vine. He will sit under his own fig tree. And the last one, there will be no one to make them afraid. There will be no fear in the land. Now you imagine living on the earth with those conditions. On the earth today, there may be pockets of people, pockets of societies here and there where some of these things, or perhaps all of these things, are true. They may worship God, they may love God, there may be peace in their land, they may not have any, they may have plenty, they may have nothing to fear. But as a general rule, that is not the case on the whole earth, certainly. Can you imagine the earth in such a way that there is peace? There is real peace. There is plenty. There is no fear. This is what we see in these five verses that John talked about a week or two ago. But right now, Micah is speaking to these people of that day, but the day they are living in, right now, Micah and his people are not living there. They are living where, you see on your outline, I've got, they're looking at tanks in the streets. They're looking at things like we see on the newspapers and in the news of chaos and turmoil and death and destruction and murders and all of these things going on worldwide. That's where they're living. That's where they're at now. And we're going to take that up in verse 6. If you have an outline, this will be point number 1 on your outline. The enslavement of God's people does not enslave God. The enslavement of God's people does not enslave God. Just because Christians are persecuted, just because Christians may end up in a dungeon, does not mean God is there. He certainly is there with them, but he is not chained by their oppressors in the sense that they are. Just because Christians are enslaved, just because they are bondage, does not mean their God is as well. God is alive. God is well. God is able. In verse 6, he says, "In that day, declares the Lord, I will assemble the lame and gather the outcast, even those whom I have afflicted. I will make the lame a remnant and the outcast a strong nation. And the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion from now on and forever. And as for you, tower of the flock, heel of the daughter of Zion, to you it will come. Even the former dominion will come, the kingdom of the daughter of Jerusalem." Micah is telling them, even though you may be outcast, even though you may be lame and crippled and whipped, there is reason to hope. God's hand is not withered. God's hand is not short, that he cannot save you, that he cannot restore even our nation, he says. Notice the one phrase in the end of verse 6. He says, "I will assemble the lame and gather the outcast." And he says this, this is what God is saying, "even those whom I have afflicted." It is important to realize and to acknowledge that the afflictions we may face, ultimately, God is sovereign over them. Micah could say God's words to his people. God says, I have afflicted you. Point number two. A prophet needs to rebuke, yet have love and humility. We're going to see this in verse 9, where Micah asks them a question. He says, I've told you about the coming of the Messiah. I've told you about his reign. I've told you how it will be. And yet here you are in turmoil and chaos. Here you are in stressed out and distress over all the things that's going on. And he asks him a question. Why are you crying aloud? Is there no king among you? Or has your counselor perished that your agony has gripped you like a woman in childbirth? Now, I want you to suggest to you how Micah asked that question. And to do it, I want to tell you a story that I heard of probably 80 years ago of a preacher named Donald Gray Barnhouse. You probably may have heard of him. Donald Gray Barnhouse was a pastor of a church, I think in the northeastern part of the United States. There was a man that lived near his church, and he would see this man frequently, just coming and going, and talk to him and talk to him about Christianity, and the man would just kind of brush him off. He wasn't interested in Christianity. He had, you know, didn't need that. And they were still, they were on friendly terms and all this. They were always talking. And this man belonged to a particular lodge, and he shared with Donald Gray Barnhouse that his lodge taught that if you adhered to the high principles that this lodge believed and practiced, that you'd be okay. When the time came and you died, that things would be okay if you had lived according to the high principles of this lodge. So he didn't need Christianity. He didn't need God. He didn't need Donald Gray Barnhouse's Savior. Well, the day came when this man became gravely ill and was not expected to live out the day. He was in the hospital, and Donald Gray Barnhouse went to see him. And the man's lodge, members of his lodge, had set up a vigil. They called it a death watch. And the idea was that they didn't want any member of their lodge to die alone. And so they were around the clock, sitting with this man at his deathbed, so that when he died, someone would be there with him. Donald Gray Barnhouse goes to the hospital to see him, and these men are there. I want to read you what he says. Donald Gray Barnhouse is there, and he asks the dying man, he says, you don't mind my staying here a few minutes and watching you, do you? He said, I have wondered what it would mean to die without Christ. And I have known you for several years now as a man who said he did not need Christ, but that his lodge obligations were enough. I would like to see a man come to the end of his life that way, to see what it is like. Do you mind if I stay and watch? Now that sounds cruel, doesn't it? In fact, the man looks at him, he says, like a wounded animal, and asked him slowly in his weak voice. He said, you wouldn't mock a dying man, would you? Now that sounds cruel, doesn't it? That sounds out of place. But he goes on to share how that he began to talk to that man again. The man in that moment realized that his lodge was doing him absolutely no good. And he asked for his family to be brought in, and he publicly denounced what he had been trusting in. I tell you, as I read that, I thought of how often it is. And I've thought this for years, but never been able to really put my finger on it or articulate it very well. But I'm afraid that we do dying people a disservice, and we do their families a disservice. When someone dies, that there is absolutely no reason to think that they go to heaven. And yet we manufacture some type of goodness that we saw in them occasionally. And we attribute that to they're in a better place. Who are we fooling? What good are we doing when we do such a thing? And I think that hard truth is what we see Micah speaking here. Micah, in almost, it looks like he's mocking them. He says, "Why are you crying? I know you're surrounded by the Assyrians who are robbing you blind. I know they're doing to you whatever you want to, and there's fear in our streets. Why are you crying? Don't you have a king? Is there not a king in Israel that will save you, who can deliver you? Where are your wise men? Have all your counselors died? Are your wise men gone? Are they all dead? Look around you. Where are they? Where are your leaders? Where are your military who will deliver you?" Obviously, he knows the answer. He knows they are not able, just like they know. And yet, I think that what we need is what I can see here. It seems like I see here in Micah, and I think it's something that we need in our day as people who will speak the truth and yet be able to do it with love, be able to do it with humility and not just arrogance. The third point that we see: the enemies of God are led gloating to their own slaughter. I'm going to start reading in verse 10. He says, "Writhe in labor to give birth, daughter of Zion, like a woman in childbirth. For now you will go out of the city, dwell in the field, and go to Babylon." Now here, Micah is speaking probably around 700 or 710 or so B.C. Judah will not go to Babylon until another 120 or so years. So here is a prophecy that is coming to pass. He's prophesying 100 years before it happens. He says, "Writhe and labor in pain to give birth, daughter of Zion," or Jerusalem, a word for Jerusalem, "like a woman in childbirth. For now you will go out of the city, you'll dwell in the field, you will end up in Babylon, and there you will be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you from the hand of your enemies. But now," verse 11, "many nations have assembled against you," and here's what these nations are saying: "Let her," or let Israel, "let Jerusalem," let Judah, "let her be polluted, and let our eyes gloat over Zion." In other words, the enemies are coming and they said, "Look at all this stuff. Let's ruin this people. Let's ruin this place. Take everything they have. They have a lot of goodies. Let's get it all. Let's take what we want for ourselves." But verse 12, "But they do not know the thoughts of the Lord." I like this verse. "They do not know the thoughts of the Lord, and they do not understand His purpose." These people who are enemies of God are in for a big surprise, aren't they? They think that they have great military power and that that will enable them to do whatever it is they decide to do. But they don't know God's thoughts. They don't know God's purposes. Notice what he says, verse 12, let's read it again. They do not know the thoughts of the Lord. They do not understand his purpose. For he, God, has gathered them like sheaves to the threshing floor. This is, if you're starting with us, the small group study, the invisible hand, you can see something here from our first two or three chapters. God, these people think that they are moving against Israel. They think by their own might they're fixing to surround Israel and take it over. What they don't realize is God is leading them there. God is bringing them to where he wants them. God is bringing them to his threshing floor. You know what happens on a threshing floor? If you're the wheat, it's not real good. God is bringing them. They think they're coming to conquer. They think they're coming to take what they want. God is bringing them to thrash them. Then the last one, in the end, it is God who will be worshipped and adored. Look in verse 13. He says, God has gathered them like sheaves to the threshing floor. And then verse 13, God says, arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion. I have brought them to you. Stand up and thresh. Here is the wheat. I've brought them to you. Give them a thrashing. For your horn, I will make iron. And your hooves, I will make bronze, that you may pulverize many peoples. You get that picture? God says, I brought them to you, and I have made you your extremities. I've made your hooves of your horses, not just a piece of cartilage or whatever a hoof is made out of, but I've turned it, it's like it's bronze. It's like I've made your weapons mighty and hard so that you may come and pulverize these people. I have brought them there so that you may pulverize them. You may smash them. The last two phrases, that you may devote to the Lord their unjust gain. In other words, you will take and give to God who the praise belongs, and their wealth to the Lord of all the earth. You see, I've entitled the message, A Holy War. When you see those three words, what do you think of? Does anybody think? What? God's war? Okay. What else? What? Jihad, okay, Islamist, holy war. We hear that phrase connected with Muslims a lot. And what we hear, and I've never read the Quran, and it's not on my list of things to do beside that. But I hear that there are sections in there, places in there where the people are called to eliminate and destroy the infidels. So that's the terms you hear. And some people make that same. They say, well, the Quran is not the only one. The Bible does the same thing. The Bible tells Christians to do the same thing. And perhaps they would turn to Micah 4:13 and say, see, here it is. What's the difference? Do you look at these verses and think God is telling you to go destroy the infidels? I don't. I don't know anybody that does. The Bible is filled with accounts of history of where there was war and the children of Israel were fighting, where there was lots of terrible things that went on and that happened. I've never read one of those things and thought God was telling me to go kill the infidels. And I don't know any Christian that has. But if there comes a day when God declares a, quote, holy war against his enemies, we'll know about it. We'll know about it. They'll know about it. There will be no doubt about it. There will be no denying it. When God gets ready to pulverize his enemies, they will be pulverized. I don't know how he would do it. I don't know when he would do it. I don't know necessarily if he would do it in just a certain way. But it sure seems as if the day will come when God will grow weary of people mocking and turning against him and making war against his people, and God will rise and act. God will lead them to their own destruction. As we look through the book of Micah, look at it in two or three lights. See it in the real historical context in which it is written, but learn to see these instances where there is prophetic statements made of things that have not yet happened in 710 B.C. We see one here that's a prophetic statement for 100 years. We see one here that's a prophetic statement that hasn't yet been accomplished. But see those things in it. And yield to God. Be grateful and thankful to God for all he's done. Let's pray. Father, as we look at your word, some things are hard. Some things are difficult, Lord, to understand. Father, that does not make your word any less true. Does not make your word any less applicable to our situation and our lives. God, I know enough about you to know the only reasonable response I could have is to worship you. God, I certainly don't know all there is to know about you, but I know enough. I know enough to feel an obligation to worship. Father, in my own limited and inadequate means, God, I desire to do that. God, glorify your holy name through my life and the lives of this church. For your honor, we pray. Amen.